Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's October 14, 2013, and this is episode 391. Having been asked many times about the neutral density filters that I use for my long exposure images, today I'm going to explain what neutral density filters are, which ones I use and how I use them, along with some ways to easily calculate your new shutter speeds and some guidelines on how much neutral density to use for various effects. Before we jump into today's episode, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use our code MBP10. We'll hear more from Squarespace later on. Basically, neutral density filters, or ND filters, stop a given amount of light from passing through your lens to your sensor, making it necessary to increase the length of the shutter speed to achieve the same exposure. There are applications where you might use an ND to shoot, say, portraits in bright light when you still want to use a wide aperture for shallow depth of field. There are also times when NDs are useful for video, because video usually looks best when shot at a 50th or 60th of a second. I've used NDs for both of these techniques, but today we're going to concentrate on the use of NDs for longer exposures and capture movement in our subjects, such as to make waterfalls look silky smooth or capture movement in clouds, etc. The idea behind the ND is that they're supposed to be totally neutral in colour, cutting down the amount of light passing through the lens without changing the colour of the resulting photographs. The filters that I use pretty much are neutral and have never been a problem, though I have heard of people getting a magenta cast on their images. My friend David Duchemin, for example, says that he gets a magenta cast sometimes when stacking two of his square resin filters, the type that attach to the front of your lens using a screw-in filter holder. I used to use these, and I think that they're useful, especially if you want to use graduated neutral density filters, which are dark on one half and clear on the other with a graduation between them. These are used to darken the sky, for example, when you have a light sky and a much darker foreground. So you use the graduated neutral density to even that out. I personally stopped using graduated neutral density filters a few years ago, as I simply haven't found them necessary since the dynamic range in our cameras became so much greater. I keep in mind that I might sometimes have to shoot multiple images to merge together in Photoshop later, but we can bring out so much detail from the shadows in Lightroom or Nik Software's Silver Effects and Color Effects Pro now that I haven't merged images like this in years either. The result is that my main use of NDs now is in the form of circular screw-in solid neutral density filters. I use a mixture of Kenko, Hakuba and Hoya filters, though mainly Kenko. I have also heard good things about B plus W filters, though I've never used these myself. Neutral density filters are often rated with a number so that we can understand how much light they will stop from entering our camera. An ND2 will block out one stop of light, so if, for example, we use this with a base shutter speed of 1/250th of a second, with one stop ND filter fitted, we'd need to adjust the shutter speed to 1/125th of a second, twice as long as the original shutter speed, because we need to let in one stop more light. And that always requires us to double one of the exposure settings, such as ISO, aperture, or shutter speed. But as I say, because most of the time we use NDs to increase the shutter speed, that's what we'll concentrate on here. The next rating you'll see is an ND4, which blocks out two stops of light, and then an ND8, which blocks out three stops of light. I know these numbers might seem a little bit counterintuitive, but if you think of these numbers 2, 4, and 8 as the denominator in fractions, it gets easier to understand. An ND2 cuts the light entering the camera by half. An ND4 cuts the light to a quarter, and an ND8 cuts the light to down to just an eighth of the original amount of light that would have entered the camera without an ND filter. So because an ND2 cuts the light entering our camera to half, we need to double the shutter speed to compensate for this. And I'm sure you already know that it, you know, if we double the shutter speed, we're increasing it by one stop. So this is why an ND2 gives us one stop of darkness, an ND4 gives us two stops, and an ND8 gives us three stops of darkness or longer exposure. This calculation is continued with the not so commonly seen values ND16, ND32, ND64, and so on. Each consecutive rating halves the amount of light it passes through compared to the previous value filter. The next value filter I own is an ND400, which of course isn't really a fraction in the series. The natural progression would be an ND128, an ND256, and then an ND512, as we keep halving. But the manufacturers decided that ND400 would be a good value to add to the range too, and this does still cut the light down by a 400th. So if we do the math, we find that this is an 8 2/3 stop filter. The absolute darkest ND filter I own, which is actually made for directly photographing the sun, is an ND100,000, which cuts the light down to literally 1/100,000th of its original brightness. This filter can give me multiple hour exposures if I want to, or still take me down to multiple minutes in very, very bright conditions, like when you're shooting towards the sun with the sea, where I know there's a lot of reflectivity there. Okay, so I know I'm geeking out here, but before we move on, I'd just like to cover the other neutral density number system that you might see quoted on ND filters, and that's the optical density. Now, although I've figured out how to do these calculations in Excel using logarithmic formula, Wikipedia says, and I quote, "For an ND filter with optical density, the amount of optical power transmitted through the filter can be calculated from the logarithm of the ratio of the measurable intensity after the filter to the incident intensity." That helped me to develop my Excel spreadsheet, but I've never really felt that there is any benefit in trying to figure out what the hell that means. So let's just look at a table of the values as a reference. And as usual, you know, I often embed images that I'm talking about in the Enhanced podcast. But, you know, well, this table, I've put it into the Enhanced podcast as well. But it's also on the blog, as with the, you know, the transcript, especially with these episodes that I go into a lot of numbers and things. It's great to go over and actually follow along with the manuscript. So go to mbp.ac/391. And you can see the, you know, read as well as listen, and all of the images plus the table is there. I'm not going to read out all of the values, but basically the optical density and everything, it's all in one table, and you can use this to understand how it they relate to the numbers that we just looked at, like ND400, etc. You'll also see that I included the f-stop reduction and the percentage of transmission here too. The percentage of transmission is the amount of light that gets through. So starting at 100% with no filter, and it drops to 50% for one filter and 25% for one stop filter and 25% for a two stop filter and so on. This isn't used to rate ND filters for photography use though, so you don't need to be too concerned about this. The f-stop reduction for each filter is useful though, so do take a look at the chart, especially if you have a filter which has a known optical density but you aren't sure of its ND rating, for example, or how many stops it actually reduces the light by. Although I own a couple of ND4 two-stop filters, I actually don't carry them with me anymore. I mainly carry my ND8 and ND400 filters in both 77 and 82 millimeter filter sizes. I also have a circular polarizer in each size, and all six of these filters live in an envelope-style filter case from a company called Marumi here in Japan. That it's really slim. I've put an image of this on the blog as well, and it's in the Enhanced podcast, but I've numbered the filters. You can actually see which filter is which, just to give you a reference. But there's a photo so that you can see it. I don't have two of these. I just merged, did a composite and put the closed up filter pouch in the same image so that you can see that. But it fits nicely in my vest pocket and basically lives there the whole time when I'm out shooting. I also carry the ND100,000 in my camera bag just in case I need it. I should also mention that it's okay to stack filters. I've included an image as well as of two stacked filters on the blog, and the calculations for your new ND value when doing this is really easy. You literally just add the two stops for each filter together. So for example, when I used an ND4 and an ND8 filter, I would sometimes stack them together for five stops of darkness. You know, 2 + 3, 5 stops of darkness. Nowadays, the ND8 and the ND400 give me a hair under 12 stops of darkness. And this is enough to get me down to between 10 seconds and a couple of minutes in the middle of the day, depending on how much light I have to start with. I know that there is a lot of polarity out there surrounding whether or not you should use a protector filter. And if you don't use them, that's fine. It's your decision. But I do use them, and intend to continue to use them for a number of reasons that I'm not going to go into today. The reason I mention this, though, is because if you do use a protector filter, you'll often need to remove the protector filter when you stack multiple neutral density filters. I try to buy narrow-framed filters when available, so I can often get away with one ND on top of a protector filter. But using two causes vignetting where the corners of the frame go dark. On my 16-35 and 24-70mm lens when used at the wide end. So whenever I'm stacking filters, I take my protector filter off first. Another way to avoid vignetting, of course, is to use the large square filter systems like the Lee system. But I'm not a fan of square filters. They have their benefits, like only having to buy one system that you can easily use with many filter thread sizes. But I can use, a step down filter on my circular filters if I really wanted to do that as well. I choose not to do that for the same reason that I choose not to use the large square filter system though, which is because there's no easy way to use a lens hood with either solution. Lee apparently do an absolutely awful lens hood for their system that very few people like. And once you start using a larger screw-in filter with a step-down adapter, your lens hoods can't be attached either. And while we're on the subject of systems that I don't personally like, I'm not a fan of the variable neutral density filters that can change in density as you rotate the front element. These are basically two polarizing filters that create varying amounts of darkness depending on the rotational relationship to each other. But because they are polarizing, they're using polarization to create the effect, the results can be pretty nasty when used on wide angle lenses, with some parts of the scene being much darker than others. I bought a Singray Vari ND, and although it worked well with longer focal length lenses and I found it useful for video, it was pretty much useless on my 16-35mm lens, so I stopped taking it out with me. I've attached a single image to the Enhanced podcast that shows the patchiness, the way you get this like a two triangles of darkness and then two triangles of light all joining together. It's pretty nasty. I've put one image in the Enhanced podcast and I've put two on the blog. So if you go over to the blog and actually click on the images to open them up and view them much larger and then go back and forth with your mouse key or your keyboard arrow keys, you can see the effect that I'm talking about here. Both images were shot at 20mm, but with the ND rotated slightly differently. The first on the left on the blog was shot at 1.6 seconds with a bit of the effect showing, but then the second image on the right was a 4-second exposure, and as I tried to get a longer exposure, but also in an attempt to get rid of the patchy darkness that can be obviously clearly seen on the images, I ended up just giving up, and this was pretty much the end of the story for the Vari ND for me. Another reason that I don't like variable ND filters is because they don't give you a definitive indication of the levels of density. All of the variable NDs that I've seen have a series of notches or marks without any numbers, so you can't easily just set them to exactly 7 stops, for example. You can take a good guess, but then you may end up, you know, basing a 2-minute exposure on that guess, only to find out that it's under or overexposed. And I don't want to mess around guessing with exposures that long. The fact that they give you a smooth transition between often 2 and 8 or up to 10 stops of density can be a benefit, of course, and is workable if you're using aperture priority or otherwise allowing the camera to control the exposure, because you just rotate the filter and then let the camera do the math. I rarely use aperture priority though, as many of my longer exposures are more than 30 seconds anyway, which is the longest exposure that my camera will do before I have to jump into bulb mode and do my own exposure calculations anyhow. Before we move on, I'd like to once again thank our sponsors, Squarespace. Squarespace is an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MBP10. One of the biggest problems photographers have when we put websites together is finding a tool or system that allows you to do everything that you need in just one place. The result is that photographers often end up with multiple sites covering their various requirements. You might have one site for your portfolios, another site to sell prints, and yet another site from which you blog or interact with your audience socially. With Squarespace, you get all of this and more in one place, and it's incredibly easy to set up. So you save time creating your site. You only have one site to maintain when you're done, and that removes one of the largest headaches that most of us face. Even once you're set up, maintaining your online presence is a breeze. You can add images instantly with drag and drop directly from your desktop onto your browser. They have many templates with beautiful full bleed image display, which is perfect for photographers and designers to showcase their work. And you can switch between templates without having to rework everything. There are hundreds of customizable settings, including font colors and sizes. Every Squarespace website can be made to look unique with just a few clicks. Squarespace gallery blocks can be added anywhere on your website and offer hundreds of presentation variations, including slideshows, sliders, grid layouts, and more. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. Although it's incredibly easy to use, if you do get stuck, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain if you sign up for a year. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device every time. Squarespace is e-commerce ready to provide a powerful and flexible solution. You can set up a shop and sell photographs or prints very quickly. Depending on your needs, you can also sell MP3s, ebooks, and even printed books. Digital books are delivered via customizable email links that expire 24 hours from delivery. There's a single interface for order management, tracking orders, providing customizable customer email updates, printing shipping labels, and adding coupons. Squarespace Commerce is now available in 10 countries: the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, and the Netherlands, as well as Spain. Start a trial with no credit card and you just start building your site. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MBP10 to get 10% off and to show your support for Martin Bailey Photography. We thank Squarespace for their support. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. So let's look now at how I do my exposure calculations in the field. For exposures up to a few seconds, I generally just use live view on my camera with exposure simulation turned on, so I can see the live histogram and know exactly where my exposure is, and don't really need to do anything special or any difficult mental calculations. If you don't have live view or a live histogram, you can just shoot your frame and then check your histogram in image playback and adjust as necessary. Remember that you generally want the brightest part of your image, which is the right side of the graph, to be touching the right shoulder of the histogram box. These days, there is usually a line around the box, so it's easy to see. But if your camera is getting a little bit long in the tooth, you may need to be careful with this, as many didn't have the box around the histogram a few years ago. See the episode Exposing to the Right, which I did a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago actually, if you want more information on why it's better to expose this way. And I'll put a link to this in the blog post if you don't know where that is. One thing to note too is that when you use a heavy ND, like an ND8 or heavier, even darker, like the ND400 or ND8 and the ND400 together, it starts to get very difficult to see, if not impossible to see through the viewfinder to compose your shot. What I sometimes do is set up my shot, deciding on the composition and get it all focused, and then find my ideal exposure without the neutral density filter on, and then screw the filter or filters onto the front of the lens and mentally calculate my new exposure. For example, in this shot, I was photographing a waterfall in daytime, and without the neutral density filter, the shutter speed will have been about a 20th of a second at f16 with ISO 200. In this case, I only intended to use an ND8, so all I needed to do was to put the filter on and then adjust and check the exposure in live view. But what I generally find myself doing is counting down in clicks, and this means that all I need to do is to increase the shutter speed from a 20th of a second is to count by 9 clicks on the main dial, and that's 3 clicks per stop multiplied by 3. And if necessary, you can actually use this technique for heavier ND combinations. If I use the 8 2/3 stop ND400, I can literally just count down in sets of 3 clicks, folding a finger for each 3, which is 1 stop until I get to 8 stops, and then just add 2 more clicks for the last 2/3. The Japanese way to count to 10 on one hand, well, just counting on one hand, is useful here because I'm using my second hand, my right hand, to rotate the dial. So I start with one hand, with all fingers open, all 5 fingers extended, and that means 0. And then you fold the thumb in, and that gives you 1. And then while counting 3 clicks, I then fold the index finger for 2 stops and then count another 3 clicks. And then on the main dial, I'm moving these along. So 3 clicks, move the thumb in, 1 stop. And then another 3 clicks, move the index finger in, fold the index finger over for 2 stops. And then you just keep going until you get down to the pinky or little finger, and that's 5 stops. So you've done 3 clicks per finger and you're now at 5 stops. Then I re-extend the little finger for 6 stops, still counting 3 clicks per finger. And then by the time you work your way back up, by the time you get to your middle finger, that will be 8 stops. So you know where you are, and then you just count the 2 more clicks and you're at 8 2/3 for your final exposure. If I'm using my ND400 with my ND8 for 11 2/3 of a stop, I'd keep going until I have all my fingers extended again and I know that I'm at 10. and then you simply start again, folding the thumb back down for the 11th stop, and then rotate the dial twice more for the final 2/3. One problem with counting and clicking with this much neutral density, of course, is that if you're working in, if you're not working in bright conditions, you'll go past 30 seconds. And as I said, the camera won't go past 30 seconds. And so just by rotating the main dial, it'll stop there. So you have to go into bulb mode and use a cable release or a timer. And we'll get to that in a moment. For me, though, what I know that if I am at 125th of a second, that's the slowest base shutter speed that I can be using before I'll go past 30 seconds with my ND8 and the ND400 together. So if my shutter speed is slower than 125th of a second, I start with two clicks on the main dial, and that's basically because 2/3 is more difficult to calculate later when I'm just doubling numbers and things. So I start with the two clicks to get them out of the way. And then I basically know I need to go another 11 stops on my fingers. As an example, let's say we just have a base shutter speed of 1/100th of a second. From there, I count my first two clicks of a stop, taking me down to 1/60th of a second. Now I have 11 full stops to count out to get my new exposure. That will take me through 1/30th, 1/15th, 1/8th, 1/4, 1/2 second, and then I get to 1 second after 6 stops. Once you get to full seconds, I stop clicking the main dial and start doubling the seconds in my head. So 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 8, 16 to 32 seconds, which is the time I have to program into my remote timer. Note too, that if I want to go even longer than 32 seconds, using the same example of starting from 1/100th, which is not always going to be the case, but if I want to go past 32 seconds, I'll start looking at my aperture and ISO again. Generally, I will be using ISO 100, but changing the ISO to 50, for example, would take me from 32 to 64 seconds. If I was already at F16, I might consider going down to F22, although I don't like to do that too much because of diffraction. That starts to make the image softer. But if that will get me to 64 seconds, or maybe even, I'd use the ISO and that to go to 128 seconds or 2 minutes and 8 seconds, then I might go for that and deal with the diffraction later using the Canon digital lens optimizer that's built into the digital professional, that horrible program that I don't like to start up. But I rarely use that because my current lenses don't suffer too much from diffraction. Anyway, this may not be a very scientific way of doing these calculations, but it works for me. And remember that a lot of the time I'm all togged up, and even, I might even have gloves on if I'm in really cold conditions. So getting my phone out and using an ND calculator can actually take me longer. Plus, most of the ND calculators available don't give you the ability to stack filters, or they don't have the ND400 in the list, or they use optical density instead of the ND number. So I generally just find them frustrating to use. And when we get around to adding the functionality to do ND calculations to my iPhone app, it might be a different story. But at the moment, I've not found one that I really like. So as I said, you will run into problems, especially on Canon cameras, if your exposure goes past 30 seconds, because most of them only go to 30 seconds at their longest camera timed exposure. After that, you have to start to use the bulb mode. In bulb mode, and that's B-U-L-B for those of you that are having problems with my Nottingham accent, you have to use a cable release or a remote release and time the exposure yourself, or a remote timer, and program the exposure time in, and then press a button and it will start the exposure and stop right at the end automatically. If you have a basic cable release, you need to start the exposure by pressing the button and then time it and release the button to stop the exposure. Most cable releasers have a locking mechanism, so you don't actually have to hold the button the whole time. But I think I'd find it a pain to sit over a stopwatch or count out seconds on my watch while the exposure is made. Another quick tip here on the use of remote timers, I generally use a 2-second timer before I start my exposure so that the camera is totally free of any vibration that I might have caused by touching the camera by the time the exposure starts. Because of this, I just add 2 seconds to the exposure time that I set with the remote timer. This way, the remote timer starts and the 2-second timer on the camera starts initially, and then when the real exposure starts 2 seconds later, I get the exposure time that I want. Also, if it's windy, tie the remote timer or cable release around the tripod so that it doesn't dangle and bang on the tripod legs, vibrating the setup. If it's really windy, I hold the remote timer, ensuring that I don't pull on the cable, which would again wiggle the camera, messing up my shot. I've often thought that it would also be a good idea to put some Velcro or magic tape on the back of the timer and another piece on my tripod legs, just one of the tripod legs, so that I could just stick the timer on there while the exposure's being made. Note too that I haven't mentioned mirror lockup because basically I don't use it anymore. Some of the early DSLR cameras with live view used to still jiggle the mirror around before they started the exposure, even when shooting in live view. So mirror lockup was necessary for a while. But now, if you're shooting in live view mode, the mirror is already up and doesn't move when the exposure starts. So mirror lockup isn't necessary when shooting in live view, which I use pretty much exclusively while I'm shooting long exposures. I'm able to do this even in bulb mode because the live view on the Canon cameras actually still gives you a pretty good idea of what you're shooting. With an ND8 and even sometimes with the ND400, depending on how light the scene is before I apply the filters, you can actually still see. It gives you a pretty good idea. So this brings me to another useful technique that I sometimes use when applying a lot of neutral density. Although live view can give you that pretty good idea of what the image looks like, even while I have a certain amount of neutral density applied, once the available light drops or you start to really go heavy on the NDs, even live view goes dark and you can't see to compose your images or focus. In these situations, you can remove the filters and check the composition and focus through the lens if there's enough available light still. But another trick you can try is to just crank your ISO way up. For example, if you have an ND400 on for just under 9 stops of neutral density, you're shooting an ISO 100, you can crank your ISO up as high as it goes, which will usually give you about 8 or 9 stops more sensitivity. The image on the LCD gets very grainy when you go this high, but you can often still at least see to compose your image and usually see well enough to just to see when your focus peaks. It might not be totally sharp at that ISO, but you can at least see when it peaks and then drop back a little bit. This is often easier than removing the filters and is especially useful if the front of your lens rotates when you focus, as this can shift your focus as you screw the filters back on otherwise. Okay, so earlier we looked at a waterfall photograph that I shot at 0.4 seconds. Waterfalls will smooth over from, like that, from around a quarter of a second, while maintaining a little bit of texture. They really start to smooth over from around half a second or more. I shoot waterfalls with up to 2 or 3 second exposures too, if I really want to smooth the water over. It really depends on the effect that you're looking for. I rarely shoot waterfalls in direct sunlight as well, as they just look terrible with all the contrast. It's usually either cloudy or I visit them on a day or at the time of day when I know that they'll be in the shade due to the position of the sun. This means that you can usually get down to around a half a second quite easily with a three-stop ND8 filter. Falling water is moving quite fast though. If you want to smooth over the sea, which moves slower and doesn't smooth over as easily, or even clouds that move slower still, you have to use more neutral density. Coincidentally, if we continue using the 1/20th of a second starting exposure that I had before adding the ND8 for the waterfall photo that we viewed earlier, I would get a 20 second exposure if I used the ND400 instead. I don't know, it's probably just me, but I like it when numbers do that, you know, like what, the 20th to a 20 second exposure. I don't know, it's just me. But 20 seconds will smooth over a relatively rough sea, but it won't give you much cloud movement. Of course, it depends on how quickly the clouds are moving, but generally, if you want cloud movement, you'll want to go down to at least 30 seconds, and if possible, go down to a minute or more than a minute. This photo that I'm showing now from the Falklands a few years ago was a 2-minute 30-second exposure. So the clouds have moved significantly. You can also see that the relatively rough sea has smoothed over, leaving some texture, which I quite like in the shot. There's also a seagull in the bottom left of the frame that stayed very still for me during the exposure. There were also some gulls on the boat that moved, leaving some ghostly outlines, which I also generally like. Notice too that more often than not, I convert my long exposure images to black and white in SilverFX Pro. Sometimes the color version works, but in general, I just think that long exposures look better in black and white. One last thing that I wanted to touch on before we finish is that once you slow your shutter speed down with neutral density, you're not only going to need a tripod, you're going to need a good sturdy tripod. Don't think that just because you are going to have to carry it for a while that you can get away with a flimsy little thing. Also, don't fall into the trap that all Jitso tripods, for example, are good. Jitso make a whole range of tripods, and even their smaller carbon fiber tripods don't cut it for long exposures with heavy gear, especially when the wind gets up. For long exposures, you're going to have to bite the bullet and use a big sturdy tripod. See my episode on what tripods I use and when for more information on this. And again, I'll put the links to that in the blog. So I hope this was useful for you. As you know, I love long exposures and try to make time to do them whenever possible. It does take more time, literally, but you really find yourself in a location for a while if you start making a couple of exposures, and you'll watch the clouds, see what they're doing. Try a few different shutter speeds. Try to shoot a few different frames and enjoy the process. Of course, long exposures also work with people on a busy street in the middle of the day, and you might get one person that stands still for you. The possibilities once you start to get into this are endless. So I hope that you give it a try, and if you don't already do it, of course. So thanks very much for listening today. Remember, you can find me on Google+, Twitter and Facebook, and links to everything that I'm up to are on martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.